Chapter 7. New Targets. When FBI agents arrested Fawaz Yunus, a Lebanese terrorist who had hijacked a plane at Beirut International Airport, it looked like another coup for the Bureau. Yunus, a used car dealer who reported directly to the leadership of the Shiite Amal militia, had commandeered a Royal Jordanian jet on June 11, 1985. He brutalized its armed guards and demanded that the plane fly him and his henchmen to Tunis, so he could deliver a message to a meeting of the Arab League. When the plane was denied landing privileges, Yunus had the pilots fly him back to Beirut. After allowing the passengers to leave, Yunus had his fellow terrorists blow the plane up as he read a ringing statement on the need to expel Palestinians from Lebanon, his embattled homeland. Three Americans were among the passengers who were released unharmed. 2 years later, the FBI arrested Yunus after he had been lured to an 81-foot yacht off the coast of Cyprus. Not revealed at the time was the fact that the CIA had enticed Yunus onto the boat in the first place. The CIA's involvement was made possible by a classified intelligence directive, known as a finding, signed by President Reagan in January 1986. It authorized the CIA to identify terrorists who had committed crimes against Americans abroad and help bring them to the U.S. for trial. The action resulted from a recommendation by a task force under the direction of then-Vice President George Bush. A few months later, Congress passed legislation giving the FBI authority to investigate all terrorist acts against Americans and to go after those responsible, no matter where. That same year, CIA Director William Casey established a counterterrorism center. Its purpose was to bring together each of the agency's directorates to deal with terrorism and to coordinate the CIA's efforts with other federal agencies. Since then, three other centers have been established, one to combat narcotics, one to direct counterintelligence, and a third non-proliferation center to coordinate intelligence on the spread of nuclear weapons and delivery systems. While the centers are housed within the CIA's Directorate of Intelligence, or in the case of the Counterintelligence Center, in the Directorate of Operations, they are considered to be intelligence community activities that coordinate with the dozens of other intelligence agencies in the government. Under the U.S. intelligence system, the Director of Central Intelligence coordinates the work and submits the budgets of each agency within the intelligence community. The first director of the Counterterrorism Center was Dewey Claridge, a flamboyant CIA operations officer given to smoking large cigars and working 16-hour days. It was the Counterterrorism Center under Claridge's direction that lured Yunus into the trap. The instrument for that scheme was Jamal Hamdan. Originally a Drug Enforcement Administration informant, Hamdan knew Yunus, and in March 1987 the CIA began paying him to renew their friendship. Over the next 7 months, the two men had nearly 60 phone conversations and meetings, most of them recorded by the CIA. Obligingly, Yunus detailed his complicity in the hijacking for his friend. In one such encounter in Hamdan's high-rise apartment in Cyprus, Yunus confided, "I got inside and I locked the plane's captain in the cockpit. The people were on the floor, their hands on their heads. Everyone, no exceptions. I got a stewardess and asked her about the security men. There were 8. I took their neckties and tied their hands behind their backs. We started beating them. We took 4 machine guns and 8 pistols from them. We kept them tied up 48 hours. Under CIA direction, Hamdan conned Yunus into thinking he could make him rich. At one point, he lent him $4,000. Finally, he told him he would introduce him to a drug dealer named Joseph. Yunus, who was then unemployed, had 2 young sons to support. He could not wait. Hamdan arranged for Yunus to meet him in Cyprus on September 11th at the Sheraton Hotel in Limassol, Cyprus. On the morning of September 13th, they took a speedboat from the hotel marina. After 90 minutes, they were in international waters. It was then that they boarded a yacht called Skunk Kilo, supplied by the Pentagon. 2 attractive women, both FBI agents, were lounging on the deck. But instead of introducing Yunus to Joseph, 2 other FBI agents kicked Yunus's feet from under him and slammed him to the deck. Yunus landed on both his wrists, breaking them. FBI Special Agent Dmitry Drudzinski, who spoke Arabic fluently, informed Yunus that he was being arrested for a terrorist act against American citizens and would be taken to the United States for trial. Eunice was convicted of conspiracy, hostage-taking, and air piracy. He is serving a term of 30 years at Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary in Kansas. Well before the CIA established a counterterrorism center in 1986, the agency had been involved in combating the problem. For example, 7 South Moluccan terrorists, armed with explosives, a carbine, pistol, and knives, took over the Indonesian consulate in Amsterdam on December 4, 1976. Demanding that the Dutch government recognize the non-existent Republic of South Malacca in Indonesia, they took hostage 21 children who were attending school that day in the building, along with 15 others. The terrorists lined a room with explosives. They threatened to blow up the hostages. The Amsterdam police decided they would only storm the embassy if any hostages were shot. Meanwhile, with the consent of the Dutch government, the CIA dispatched a technician who crawled through a sewer pipe and into the embassy's basement. There he planted a listening device in a wall so the CIA could eavesdrop on the terrorists. Several days later, a gun went off inside the embassy. The police were about to storm the building, which would have meant many of the hostages would have been killed. But the listening device picked up the fact that one of the terrorists had accidentally dropped his gun, and it had gone off. The police waited out the terrorists. After 15 days, they finally gave up. Each was sentenced to 6 years in jail. Because the CIA had known what was going on inside the embassy, no lives were lost. Operating from the 6th floor of the old CIA building in McLean, the Counterterrorism Center today has some 200 CIA employees. In addition, 10 people are detailed from other agencies, including the FBI, NSA, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Defense Department. Among other things, the center lists terrorist organizations and threats on a computer system available to other government agencies. Known as DESIST, the system is manned 24 hours a day. The Counterterrorism Center coordinated the government's investigation of the destruction of Pan Am 103, the plane that exploded 4 days before Christmas 1988 over Lockerbie, Scotland, killing all 259 passengers and crew members on board. With the help of other agencies and countries, the CIA determined that high-ranking Libyan officials, including the brother-in-law of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, ordered the bombing of that plane and a French jumbo jet that exploded in midair in 1989. The bombings were believed to be in retaliation for the 1986 bombing of Tripoli by U.S. warplanes. In preventing terrorism, the Counterterrorism Center operates behind the scenes. If a known terrorist is traveling, the CIA passes the word to each country on his itinerary. The countries either refuse to allow the terrorist to enter, or if he is a fugitive, have him arrested. The CIA's role rarely comes out. Several years ago, the CIA proposed to the State Department that it threatened to expose the fact that countries such as Hungary were helping to subsidize the operations of Abu Nidal's terrorist organization by allowing it to set up companies that traded with Hungary. It later turned out that Hungary had also given refuge to an international terrorist known as Carlos in 1979. The State Department agreed to the plan, which entailed drawing up a white paper detailing Hungary's complicity. The plan worked. "We discovered we had a new weapon, the threat of publicity," a former State Department official said. "In every case it worked. We got cooperation. We've taken terrorism from the late 1970s, when there were more than 100 incidents a year with several casualties and deaths, to the point where it is de minimis domestically, including foreign groups operating in the U.S., Oliver Buck Revell, a former associate deputy director of the FBI, said. "This is due in part to the Counterterrorism Center." The coordinated approach has been so successful that William Webster set up 2 additional centers, one to combat narcotics and one to coordinate counterintelligence. A third center to combat proliferation began in September 1991, under acting CIA Director Richard J. Kerr. Headed originally by Howard Hart, a ruddy-faced former operations officer, the Counter-Narcotics Center consists of several hundred CIA employees who work in windowless offices in the basement of the new CIA headquarters building. The staff includes photo interpreters, political analysts, operations officers, and technicians. In addition, representatives of each intelligence organization and federal law enforcement agency in the government are detailed to the center for 2-year terms. The center collects information about narcotics trafficking so it can be used by law enforcement agencies to help obtain arrests and convictions. With the aid of satellites, the center tracks drug shipments on the high seas and pinpoints laboratories and fields where the coca and other drug-related plants are grown. It then passes the information to local law enforcement agencies so they can take action. Until the Gulf War, the Counter-Narcotics Center was one of the largest users of satellite time in the CIA. Like the other two centers, the CIA's Counterintelligence Center is a community-wide function. Originally headed by Gardner R. Gus Hathaway, a former chief of the Soviet East Europe Division and a former Moscow station chief, it concentrates on countering efforts by hostile intelligence services to thwart and penetrate the CIA within the U.S. and particularly overseas. Its function overlaps to some degree with the Office of Security, which is charged with protecting the agency and its secrets. Within the modern CIA, the approach that James Angleton brought to counterintelligence is a bad memory. There is a misconception that counterintelligence officers need to be a different breed, suspicious to the point of being paranoid. Often, this outlook is referred to as a counterintelligence mentality. This is pure malarkey. People who catch spies need to be no more and no less suspicious than people who catch murderers, bank robbers, or white-collar criminals. To be effective, any professional investigator must bring a balanced approach to his job. Angleton's paranoiac mindset cast a pall on efforts to use information from defectors. At the same time, he created suspicions about anyone who had anything to do with Soviets, damaging the CIA's efforts to recruit agents. Angleton refused to believe that there was a split between the Chinese communists and the Soviets, even after soldiers from both sides had killed each other. He insisted on believing Anatoly M. Golitsyn, a KGB officer who defected in 1961, when all the evidence showed that Golitsyn tailored his stories to suit Angleton's preconceptions. Angleton was convinced that debriefing defectors would somehow contaminate the CIA by revealing the agency's secrets. In fact, the questions asked of defectors are what anyone would expect to be asked, based on the defector's status and access. They give away no secrets at all. The fact that the CIA asks a defector if there are any moles in the agency, for example, does not necessarily mean the CIA has a clue that one actually exists. Mole is a popular term that refers to an intelligence officer who penetrates an opposing intelligence service, usually having already worked there. According to Tom Mangold's Cold Warrior, Angleton sat on tips about major spies in foreign countries because they came from an FBI source codenamed Knickknack rather than from his favorite defector, Golitsyn. Knickknack was an officer with the GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence, who had temporarily been posted to New York and other locations in the early 1960s and again in the early 1970s. When Angleton's successors uncovered the files years later, Knickknack's tips led to the arrests of former Swiss Air Defense Chief Jean-Louis Jeanmaire in 1976 and in 1978 of members of a spy ring in France led by Serge Fabius. Because the FBI immediately passed some of Knickknack's information directly to the British, his leads had already led to the conviction of Frank Bossard, a former British Royal Air Force officer working as an engineer in guided missile research in the Air Ministry of the War Department. If any other CIA officer or FBI agent had suppressed such information, he would almost certainly have been fired and would probably have faced a criminal investigation as well. Beyond his ineptitude, Angleton presided over some of the worst abuses later exposed by the Church Committee, including the CIA's programs for opening mail between the U.S. and Soviet bloc countries and for compiling files on dissident Americans. Besides exceeding the CIA's charter, neither of these programs ever developed any information of any value. No Soviet spies were ever uncovered as a result. Nor did the CIA find any foreign involvement in the anti-war movement during the 1960s. Much of what Angleton did was not only a waste of time, it was foolish. For example, after Ramparts exposed in 1967 that the CIA was funding the National Student Association, Angleton prepared lengthy analyses of the themes in Ramparts' articles. In an attachment to a memo he sent to the FBI, Angleton wrote that the magazine had hardened from a new left organ to an outlet for standard Soviet propaganda. He based this on the percentage of time certain themes appeared in the magazine's articles. How many times they said the United States was sick, for example. How many times they said the present U.S. government was fascistic. How many times the magazine said the Catholic Church was reactionary and hierarchical. And how many times the publication said the FBI and CIA were evil. The fact is, for all the harm Angleton did by closing off potential sources of information, ignoring tips, abusing the rights of Americans, and unfairly accusing CIA employees of consorting with the enemy, Angleton never did catch a spy. During Angleton's tenure, Carl Kecker, a Czech intelligence service officer, became a CIA employee and was given sensitive translating tasks. It was Kecker who compromised Alexander D. Ogorodnik, a high-ranking Soviet diplomat then working for the CIA. Yet Angleton never had a clue about this major spy case within his own agency. The author interviewed Angleton in April 1987, a month before he died, and brought up the subject of Kecker. All along, there really had been a mole in the CIA, one who had been hired a year before Angleton was forced to retire, and who had later done great damage to the agency. While totally lucid, Angleton showed no interest in the case. For Angleton, it seemed, it had all been a game. Kecker was not the mole he was seeking. Since he was not his mole, Kecker was of little interest to him. Before the Church Committee hearings, the CIA underwent little outside scrutiny and could easily lose sight of its mission. Operations took on a life of their own, and art was pursued for art's sake. Angleton was a prime example of that danger, an amateur who was allowed by a string of CIA directors to wreak havoc within the agency. In contrast, the FBI is held accountable by the courts when it develops an espionage case against a suspect. That means it must deal in the real world of evidence and facts, and the goal is always clear, to put spies in jail. Before a case ever gets to court, it is reviewed by the Justice Department. In the face of outside scrutiny, an amateur is quickly detected. When he became CIA director, William Colby realized Angleton was doing far more harm than good. "You will now leave, period," Colby told Angleton in December 1974. Angleton died on May 11, 1987. For all his faults, Angleton was a brilliant, gracious man, a poet and a grower of orchids, who still has a following among some retired CIA officers of his era. His greatest contribution was obtaining through Shin Bet, Israel's domestic security agency, Nikita Khrushchev's secret speech in 1956 denouncing Joseph Stalin for his criminal cruelty and misgovernment. But within the modern CIA, Angleton has virtually no defenders. "I think there were a number of things done under Angleton that should not have been done," a recently retired operations officer said. "Watching students, keeping lists of names, opening mail. He ran his own little world and got away with it somehow." Counterintelligence under Angleton was more of a suspicion-building program rather than a shield, which it should be and which it certainly is today, William Webster said at a final breakfast meeting with reporters who cover intelligence, just after he announced his retirement from the CIA in 1991. But it would be unfair to single out Angleton for blame. Most of the abuses he engaged in had been approved by CIA directors at the time and even attorneys general of the U.S. Nor was counterintelligence the only area where those abuses occurred. Chapter 8. The Rogue Elephant. On June 17, 1972, burglars broke into Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate office building in Washington. A security guard called the district police, who promptly arrested the burglars. As their story unraveled, it turned out most of the participants in the break-in had some sort of CIA connection. James McCord had retired from the CIA's Office of Security in 1970. E. Howard Hunt had retired the same year from the CIA's Directorate of Operations. Bernard Barker had been recruited by the CIA when he was in the Cuban police, and he later worked for Hunt when Hunt was in the CIA. He stopped working for the agency in 1966. Eugenio R. Martinez had been a CIA contract employee and was still on the CIA's payroll when the break-in occurred. As it turned out, the CIA knew nothing about the break-in. but the connections to the agency fueled suspicions that the agency was out of control. Because of the growing mistrust of the government because of its handling of the Vietnam War, these suspicions received more credence than they might otherwise have. The suspicions had begun in 1967, when Rampart's magazine revealed that the CIA had been providing funds to the National Student Association. The money was to be used to help the student group prevent takeovers of international youth organizations by communists. Unlike opening mail and infiltrating dissident groups, supplying money to domestic organizations was not a direct violation of the CIA's charter. Supporting an American organization did not mean the CIA was engaging in internal security functions. But the funding did raise the specter of the agency trying to influence America rather than the overseas targets it was supposed to sway. Moreover, it raised suspicions both in the eyes of foreigners and of Americans that U.S. institutions might have dual allegiances, one to their directors or trustees and one to the CIA. In the long run, the broader corruption of American institutions posed a greater threat to American freedoms than whether communists gained a foothold in an international youth organization. Ultimately, it was America's image as a land of freedom that was most effective in influencing nations torn between communist and democratic factions. In response to the Rampart's exposé, President Johnson appointed a three-man committee headed by former Attorney General Nicholas DeBee Katzenbach to look into the problem. It recommended that such funding be cut off. Presidents have since specifically reaffirmed the policy. Later Watergate investigations revealed even more troubling links to the CIA. The CIA had supplied Howard Hunt with a wig, a camera, a speech-altering device, and false identification papers, including a driver's license, to be used during Hunt's break-in at the offices of Dr. Lewis J. Fielding, Daniel Ellsberg's former psychiatrist, in September 1971. The Nixon White House had ordered the illegal break-in to learn more about Ellsberg's involvement in leaking the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. Then President Nixon tried to use the CIA to cover up White House connections with the Watergate break-in. His aides summoned Richard Helms, then the CIA director, to the White House. They told him that Nixon wanted him to call L. Patrick Gray, the acting director of the FBI, and tell him not to pursue some of the leads arising out of the Watergate break-in because they might reveal CIA operations or sources. Helms told the aides the story was not true, and he refused. Nixon then eased him out of the CIA, sending him to Iran to be ambassador. In his inept fashion, Nixon replaced Helms with James R. Schlesinger, who was not about to participate in any cover-ups. The revelation of the CIA's peripheral involvement in the break-in at the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist infuriated Schlesinger. To make sure no other improper activities were going on, he issued an order in May 1973, drafted by Colby, then the CIA's deputy director for operations, ordering employees of the CIA to report any suspicions they had that laws or the agency's charter had been violated. The result was what came to be referred to as the Family Jewels, 693 single-spaced typewritten pages, with each page or two devoted to a possible infraction. After he had been nominated to replace Schlesinger as CIA director, Colby turned the list over to Congress, convinced that this was the proper way to handle the matter. Consistent with their hear-no-evil-see-no-evil approach, the committee chairman with whom he discussed the jewels decided to keep it all quiet. There was a general consensus that these matters of the past should be left in the past in order that the agency could continue to do its positive work in the present and future, Colby wrote in his autobiography, Honorable Men. But a year and a half later, Seymour Hersh of the New York Times got wind of the story. In an effort to put it in perspective, Colby met with Hersh and wound up confirming the gist of what Hersh had developed independently about the abuses. Hersh's front-page December 22, 1974 story, headlined, Huge CIA Operation Reported in U.S. Against Anti-War Forces, Other Dissidents in Nixon Years, opened up the CIA to 2 years of investigations and turmoil. While many of the items turned out not to be violations or to be insignificant, the jewels contained enough dynamite to forever change the CIA and the way it does business. According to the documents and the later investigations, the CIA had begun a program in 1952 of surveying mail to and from the Soviet Union. In 1953, it began opening some of this mail in violation of federal statutes. By 1973, the CIA was examining 2.3 million pieces of mail a year, photographing 33,000 envelopes, and opening 8,700 of them. In 1967, the CIA established a special operations group within the agency to report on domestic dissidents. The program, aptly called Operation Chaos, resulted in the accumulation of 13,000 files, including ones on 7,200 American citizens. The documents in the files included the names of 300,000 American citizens and organizations. They had all been gathered as part of an internal security function, exactly what the 1947 Act establishing the CIA had forbidden. A third major area of abuse was the CIA's program for testing drugs to control behavior on unwitting victims, a violation of criminal laws. Frank E. Olson, an Army civilian scientist, committed suicide on September 28, 1953, after the CIA had given him LSD without his knowledge. The CIA officer in charge of the experiment had not checked medical records and was not aware that Olson had had suicidal tendencies over the previous 5 years. Finally, the CIA imprisoned Yuri Inosenko, the KGB major who defected to the U.S. in 1964 for 3.5 years simply because the agency did not believe his story that the KGB had nothing to do with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. That frightened me more than anything else, the idea that an intelligence agency could secretly hold a man in prison. Habeas corpus stopped that several centuries ago, Colby said. As if the illegalities were not bad enough, the ineptitude of many of the operations was astonishing. The agency's many failed assassination attempts against Castro, its mad effort to enlist the aid of the mafia, and its foolish attempts to embarrass Castro were prime examples. The exposure of the agency's activities became a watershed, one that led to a rigorous system of oversight by Congress and generally tightened procedures within the agency to ensure that it stayed within the law. Until then, subcommittees of the Senate and House Armed Services and Appropriations Committees had passed on CIA legislation. In practice, during much of the CIA's early existence, the chairman and a few other senior members of the two committees formed an ad hoc oversight committee that made all the key decisions. They took the position that the less they knew about the CIA's operations, the better. Hersh's exposé led to appointment of a president's commission, chaired by Vice President Nelson A. Rockefeller, to look into the abuses, an investigation in the Senate led by Senator Frank Church, and a third, more partisan probe in the House led by Representative Otis Pike, a New York Democrat. At the height of the probes, the Church Committee had 155 staff members looking into the CIA and other intelligence agencies. Before that, the Church investigation, supervision was virtually non-existent, Robert R. Simmons, a former staff director of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, said. They didn't want to be responsible for it. I consider that a failure of the Congress. If the Congress had acted sooner to extend its authority over this, some of those problems may never have occurred. Part of the problem in the early days was the oversight committees, particularly the chairman, who were interested in the agency being as anonymous as possible, and they made this very clear, Helms agreed. As a matter of fact, on one occasion after he became chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Stennis said, "You're doing a great job at the agency. I haven't seen your name in the paper in 6 months." That was his idea that you should be quiet about it. Yet the CIA nearly always had partners in these bizarre activities, a president or a cabinet officer. The program to collect files on dissidents had been undertaken under pressure from President Johnson. Attorney General John Mitchell and 3 Postmasters General had been informed of the program to open mail. President Kennedy or then Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy had either authorized or been informed of the efforts against Castro. All I know is Jack Kennedy and his brother were bound and determined to have us take on this effort to get rid of Castro, Helms said. If you want me to take off my jacket and show you the beatings I got over that, I'd be glad to. In retrospect, it was undoubtedly a mistake. It was feckless. But they insisted that this go on. Likewise, both Johnson and Nixon ordered the CIA to become involved in investigating dissidents. Johnson was absolutely convinced that there was foreign money and influence that caused all this student unrest, Helms said. No matter how you talked to him about this, he was convinced. Nixon was convinced in much the same way. They couldn't understand that there wasn't foreign involvement. That was how this whole thing started, to find out if this was true. Many of those involved in the questionable activities still defend them. Supporting NSA, the National Student Association, was the right thing to do overall, Cord Meyer, a former CIA officer who directed the operation, said. If it breeds mistrust, you have to make a choice between them. Either you are going to try to compete abroad or just hope for the best. Richard Bissell, who oversaw the student operation as deputy director for operations, said, That was a highly successful operation to combat communist-funded groups. It was not only justified, but quite effective. Today I would approve of it, although it is much less necessary. It would have to be done in a different way, but I would like to see that capability reconstructed. Perhaps the best case for the present system of oversight was made unknowingly by Bissell, who directed the abortive 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba as deputy director for operations. Arguing against congressional approval of covert actions such as the Bay of Pigs, Bissell said that the need for congressional notification has a suffocating effect. You have to tailor the mission to them and their staffs. If that is true, would not the devastating failure and loss of lives at the Bay of Pigs have been avoided if congressional approval had been required? If we had had to do that in the Bay of Pigs, I suspect the operation would have been called off, Bissell acknowledged. You could say we would be ahead, but you would do better to cancel every third operation on the principle that that way you will save some grief. You can't run an organization on that assumption. Bissell's response is telling. It illuminates the real reason for the failure at the Bay of Pigs. Arrogance. By Bissell's reasoning, only CIA officers know what is good for the country. Elected officials may be the representatives of the people, but they have no business questioning the judgment of the CIA. Dickie Bissell was confident the agency could do anything, John A. Bross, a longtime CIA hand, said. In the old days, if something was doable, it often was tried. Short-term success was all they looked for, Russell J. Bowen, a retired CIA analyst who continues to consult for the agency, said. The fact short-term success could be long-term failure was not important to them. Guatemala was touted as a success, but Guatemala has had an unstable government ever since. As might be expected, CIA officers were stung by the investigations and resented them. To many CIA officers involved in the abuses, William Colby was a traitor for helping to make the jewels public. It had always been our understanding, Helms said, that as long as we were testifying properly and in detail to the oversight committees, that this stuff would remain secret. So when the church committee hearings came along, it seemed to many of us that this was a betrayal of the understanding we had. Some people disagreed with my handling of it, Colby later recalled. Some think it was the only way. A lot of people wish it hadn't happened. So do I, Colby said, meaning he wished the CIA had never engaged in the activities he felt he had to bring to light. The CIA's activities 10 or 20 years earlier were being judged by the Church Committee based on criteria established 10 or 20 years later in a political atmosphere, Edward W. Proctor, a former CIA Deputy Director for Intelligence, said. Church was running for president, the House committee staff was a bunch of clowns, the Senate staff had some good people who were looking for the truth, while others were looking to make a name for themselves. It, the CIA, becomes a very tight, small family, Robert Simmons, a former CIA officer who later became staff director of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, said. When you go overseas, you're in a hardship post at risk. You value the support you get from your own people. So you develop an us-against-them mentality. When you see Church holding up a pistol and saying, look at what the CIA is doing, you say, screw him. What most infuriated CIA officers was Church's assertion, later retracted, that the agency was a rogue elephant. They pointed to the fact that nearly all the abuses had been approved by presidents or cabinet officers at the time. Moreover, most of the abuses had been stopped by the time of the committee hearings. The picture that most sticks in people's minds is a photo of Church grimly holding up a poison dart gun found at the CIA. The fact that it had never been used and had been brought to the attention of the committee by the CIA after it had been found never caught up with the picture. and because it appeared in CIA files, a description of an army experiment to see how fast poison would spread in the New York City subway system created the impression the CIA had been running through the subway spreading poison. I never believed it was a rogue elephant, William G. Miller, who was staff director of the Church Committee and later of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, said. We had a dispute about that. Church was convinced it was. I did not. I felt White House's knew this, the abuses, all the way through. He came to a judgment before all the evidence was in, Miller said. He made that comment after looking at several crazy cases in which there were runaway characters. But that wasn't the general pattern. In a sense, he is right, because there were cases where cowboys ran things and were out of control. But there were very few. As for the fact that most of the abuses had stopped, that was not the issue, at least not for me or for most of the senators, Miller said. The question was how to prevent it. What were the results? What should we do for the future? In contrast to the attitudes of those involved in the abuses, CIA officers in today's agency for the most part condemn the abuses of the past as being both unnecessary and foolish. Even when they were going on, most CIA officers were not involved in them and knew nothing about them. Citing the plan to portray an image of Christ over Cuba, Herbert Saunders, a former CIA officer, said, I suppose there have always been crackpots around who think good intelligence work consists of some puerile attempts to embarrass Castro. However, I don't think that anybody would give you 2 cents for that approach now. In the modern world of intelligence, there is less interest in gimmicks and more in painstaking intelligence work by the traditional methods. It's a matter of being confident in your ability. The agency became very depressed because the information within the agency became public. John McMahon, a former CIA deputy director of operations under Casey, said, It was the first time a lot of the employees knew some of the things that the agency did. This screwing around with the drugs just everybody abhorred. The agency deserved to be chastised over that crap, McMahon said. Even though it was just a handful of people in the agency who did it, and they're a bunch of jerks, the fact is that the atmosphere permitted it. That's why I'm a great proponent of oversight. Oversight is the greatest protection for the agency because it precludes these things from happening. As one might expect, most of the abuses had occurred in the Directorate of Operations, the clandestine service devoted to breaking the laws of other countries. This raised the question of whether people who choose to be spies could ever be trusted to obey the law in this country. Evangelists do not necessarily do well in the CIA, Saunders said. The nature of the work may require that you go overseas and break the law. Foreign law, not American law. You may have to cheat and steal and tell some lies about working for some funky organization other than the CIA. It can be a pretty schizophrenic existence, and not everyone can keep their marbles rolling right. But the best officers keep it all in perspective. They may spend the good part of the day trying to figure out how to spirit the code cards out of the local Soviet embassy, but when the sun goes down, they punch out and take the wife and kids to the movies, Saunders said. Those who don't punch out sometimes find it is more than they can handle. I don't think anybody in the CIA ever had a problem with responsible scrutiny and regulation, Saunders said. The problem is irresponsible scrutiny. The winks and nods and tacit approvals. I don't want to hear these things. Don't tell me this. I need to deny any knowledge. Yet when an operation goes awry, these very same people turn on you. Despite all the abuses, probably the CIA as an organization has fewer criminal indictments than any other branch of the government, certainly fewer than Congress, Thomas Polgar, a former CIA officer, said. Day in and day out, the level of morality in the agency, particularly in the clandestine service where there are opportunities to do otherwise, has been quite high. Simmons, the former staff director of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and a former CIA officer himself, said the CIA was never a rogue elephant. What you had was an elephant taking orders from the White House, he said. The president and his men were instructing the elephant. The CIA also generated ideas. If a clandestine organization is tasked by the president to come up with a solution to a problem, there is a tendency to say, let's do something. For most Americans who lived through the hearings in 1975 and 1976, The revelations of assassination plots and attempts to remove Castro's beard are their only picture of the CIA and what it is all about. Because the agency operates in secret, they have no way of knowing of the changes that have taken place. I think the first thing that's important to recognize is the generational change in the agency, said Robert M. Gates, Deputy Director of Central Intelligence under Webster and Casey, and later Director of Central Intelligence. The bulk of the people that founded the agency and were around for its so-called halcyon days, for the most part, had retired by the mid to late 1970s. The result is that today only a quarter of the agency worked there before the Church Committee. So what you have is a whole new generation of employees and managers who have grown up in the agency in an atmosphere of both intense public scrutiny of the agency and an environment of congressional oversight. I think this group of people has grown up very much accepting of congressional oversight, Gates said. Today, as a result of the Church Committee hearings, the CIA and other intelligence organizations come under the jurisdiction of House and Senate Select Committees on Intelligence. The Senate Committee has 15 members and 40 staff members, including 25 professionals, who concentrate on particular subjects or geographic areas. The majority and minority members have access to the same information and the same staff members. Staff members receive briefings from CIA officers in room SH-219 of the Hart Office Building, around the corner from the committee. An unmarked door opens into a foyer guarded by a member of the Capitol Hill Police. Only members or staff of the committee are allowed any farther. If they bring visitors, the visitors must sign in. Inside is one of the most secure installations in the U.S. government, a bug-proof, soundproof chamber that would give the wiliest KGB bugging expert a run for his money. Protected by vaulted doors, it is a room within a room, raised so that all sides can be inspected for bugs. Made of steel, the room prevents any electromagnetic waves from entering or leaving. Even the electrical supply is filtered electronically to prevent any signal emanations. The inner room is divided into smaller rooms where CIA and National Security Agency briefers drop the biggest secrets in Washington. There is also a hearing room where the senators take closed testimony. It has mauve chairs and a map of the world over the horseshoe-shaped desk where the senators sit. The witness desk is outfitted with a public address system, but it was not loud enough to make former CIA Director William J. Casey's muttering audible, so the committee installed a separate system just for Casey. It allowed senators to plug in earphones and turn up the volume. But it did no good. Those who knew him say Casey was perfectly understandable, but only when he wanted to be heard, and the system is not now used. The House Committee is largely a mirror image of the Senate Committee, except that it has a staff for the minority party and one for the majority party. The House Committee has 19 members and 22 staff members, including 14 professionals. In addition to passing on everything the Senate Committee approves, the House Committee approves the budget for tactical intelligence and related activities by the military. Known as TIARA, this amounts to $11 billion a year. The committees receive all of the CIA's finished products, such as the National Intelligence Estimates and the National Intelligence Daily. Occasionally, staff members visit Langley to look at raw files, as the Senate Committee did during an investigation of the CIA's activities in El Salvador. The Senate Committee has three certified public accountants who examine the books of the agencies. Generally, the Senate Committee holds as many as 18 budget hearings each year on what is known as the National Foreign Intelligence Budget, some $18.3 billion a year. Of that sum, the CIA receives $3.2 billion. The greatest allocation, $6.2 billion, goes to the National Reconnaissance Office, which is in charge of developing satellites. The next highest sum of $3.9 billion goes to NSA. Together with tactical collection, the total spent for intelligence by the U.S. government is $29.3 billion a year. In addition to budget hearings, the committees hold hearings on subjects like the Soviet Union or particular problems, such as the poor security at the old American embassy in Moscow. Sometimes the committee's best information comes from the press, as happened when Al-Shira, a Lebanese magazine, reported on November 3, 1986, that then-National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane had accompanied a shipment of U.S. arms to Iran, opening up the Iran-Contra scandal. Under the 1974 Hughes-Ryan Amendment, A presidential finding declaring it is in the national interest had to precede any covert action. Each covert action had to be reported in timely fashion to the Senate and House committees. In 1980, Congress amended the National Security Act of 1947 to add a new section on oversight of intelligence activities. Under that section, the CIA had to keep the two intelligence committees informed of significant anticipated intelligence activity, which would include any unusual and especially sensitive intelligence gathering in friendly countries. In 1991, Congress passed new legislation that added more precise definitions and safeguards to the reporting requirements. It also broadened the requirements to cover any U.S. government entity, including the National Security Council. In practice, the CIA informs the committees of any important events, covert action and unusual intelligence operations, within 48 hours. Most spying in friendly countries is not considered unusual and therefore is not reported. Only rarely do congressional committees learn identities of assets or agents, and then it is usually when one has gone bad and created problems. Until William Webster became director of Central Intelligence, the committees rejected a covert action at least once a year, usually when it had something to do with supporting candidates in elections in foreign countries. One or both of the committees then wrote a letter to the president. If the president insists on going ahead with a plan, either of the committees can stop the funding for the project. More recently, the committees, while never enthusiastic about covert action, have almost never rejected a proposal. Looking into requests for covert action takes up 30% to 40% of the time of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, according to former staff director Robert R. Simmons. Covert action is a high-profile item for congressional oversight, he said. Does that mean mistakes can't be made? No. But it is politically charged. It is budgeted on a line-item basis. When Casey was director of Central Intelligence, the CIA engaged in covert action without obtaining a presidential finding in order to carry out the Iran-Contra scheme. A year after arms had been shipped to Iran, Casey, at the insistence of his deputy, John McMahon, asked President Reagan to issue a finding. That finding authorized the sales retroactively. The finding specified that Congress was not to be told about it. John Poindexter, the National Security Advisor at the time, testified that he destroyed the only copy of the December 1985 finding to save the president political embarrassment. The CIA had come full circle from the days of the Church Committee hearings. Again, it had violated the law by acceding to pressure from the White House. Again, it had gotten itself into trouble by not informing Congress of its activities. In intelligence, you have to lie, cheat, and steal to get the truth, Simmons, the former staff director of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, said. The reason is it is for your national security, but it must stop when you were dealing with your own government. Sometimes it didn't. Some of them treated Congress as they would a foreign country. If you read the Constitution, which many of those people have never done, they would find the Founding Fathers described the powers of the legislature first, Simmons said. But this time there was a difference. In the Iran-Contra affair, Congress was not at fault for not wanting to hear about it. And this time the CIA's role in the arms sales and the diversion of profits to the Contra rebels was that of expediter. Both Casey and Oliver North knew that they could not get the CIA itself to arrange and carry out the operations. The CIA could be pushed only so far, and setting up proprietaries, companies owned by the CIA as a cover, and arranging the details of arms shipments was the most it would do. That was why Oliver North had to arrange for the operation to be carried out by a self-financed arm of the National Security Council. It shows Casey could not use the agency, even though he was an aggressive director, Miller, the former staff director of the Church Committee, said. But there is another side to the story, one that rarely comes out. That is the pressure that members of Congress sometimes bring to bear on the agency to violate its own rules. Sometimes the pressure is to buy from constituents, to reinstate security clearances for employees whose clearances have been revoked, or to locate buildings in home districts of members of Congress, a rather routine occurrence in government. But at times the pressure takes a more unusual turn. In May 1990, the CIA invited Representative Bud Shuster, a Pennsylvania Republican and a member of the House Select Committee on Intelligence, to speak at the agency's training center at Camp Peary in Virginia. The CIA said the agency would fly him down for the talk on a Thursday and fly him back the same day. Schuster agreed to do it, but asked to be flown back instead to Hagerstown, Maryland, not far from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, at the center of his district. Since Hagerstown is 60 miles beyond Washington, the CIA's plane would have had to travel an extra 120 miles to accommodate Schuster. The agency told him it would be against government regulations to fly him the extra distance. Schuster said he was going to his home state for legitimate business, but that made no difference to the CIA. As a member of Congress, Schuster had an official allowance to cover trips. If he went beyond that allowance, he was personally liable for them. Under the complex rules that bind government agencies, the CIA could only pick up and return Schuster to his office in Washington. Infuriated, Schuster refused to give the talk, and on May 8, 1990, he wrote an angry letter to William Webster, likening the CIA's decision to risk aversion in the intelligence business. Schuster said the symbol of the intelligence community had become a turtle with its head pulled in. He called the agency's officials Lilliputians, small-minded, petty people. "Judge, you've got a problem. We've got a problem. I fear for the security of my country," he wrote. Instead of Congress's berating the CIA for breaking the law, a member of Congress was now berating the agency for refusing to go against government regulations. Like the agency when it broke the law, Schuster was using the rubric of national security to justify his own ill-advised actions. When measured against the importance of the CIA and its effectiveness at carrying out its mission, the abuses, outrageous though each one may have been, seem relatively small. More than anything, the mission of the agency has been to uncover military developments in foreign countries so the U.S. can defend itself. To that end, no component of the CIA has been more effective than the Directorate of Science and Technology. Part 2. The Directorate of Science and Technology. Chapter 9. Seeing Through Clouds. The most critical question for the United States since the beginning of the Cold War has been the size and nature of Soviet weapons and military force. Only aerial reconnaissance can answer the question consistently with accuracy and precision. In many ways, the most important task of the CIA, this job is carried out by the Directorate of Science and Technology, which has 5,000 employees. Besides watching from space, the Directorate of Science and Technology, through the Office of SIGINT Operations, monitors the Soviet military with radar and sensors that pick up radio transmissions, called telemetry, from missiles being tested. The office also intercepts communications within countries and inside foreign embassies, and messages sent by terrorists and drug cartels. While the office often works with the National Security Agency, NSA, it specializes in tactical interceptions to supplement operations within the CIA. More generalized interceptions and analysis of communications is performed by NSA. Signals Intelligence, SIGINT, is intelligence obtained by monitoring electromagnetic waves or signals from any source, including foreign radio transmitters, radar, missiles, satellites, and spacecraft. Human intelligence, HUMINT, is intelligence collected by humans. The Directorate's Office of Special Projects uses sensors to determine locations of nuclear devices and facilities and does other special collection projects. Through the Office of Technical Service, the Directorate supplies the James Bond equipment of the spy trade, the clandestine recording devices, the transmitters that bounce encrypted messages in bursts off satellites, secret writing papers, and disguises that are essential to the job of the human spy. The Directorate's Office of Research and Development conducts research for all the directorates, attempting to develop prototypes and go beyond the state-of-the-art in such areas as communications, sensors, artificial intelligence, management of databases, and high-speed computing. Through the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, FBIS, the Directorate monitors and translates foreign media so that the government and the public will have accurate translations and transcripts of foreign newspaper articles and radio and television news programs. The FBIS also picks up and translates broadcasts of clandestine radio stations. Finally, the National Photographic Interpretation Center, NPIC, also housed within the Directorate of Science and Technology, analyzes the take from aerial reconnaissance and helps determine the meaning of the images. None of the offices is more important than the Office of Development and Engineering, which develops the major satellite systems. Its predecessor in 1954 developed the U-2 reconnaissance aircraft, a desperate attempt to find out what the Soviet Union was up to when practically every other effort had failed. Meanwhile, clandestine Soviet agents could walk into any airport, rent a plane, and fly all over the U.S., but not over military installations or the White House. The idea for the U-2 originated with the Technological Capabilities Panel, a committee headed by MIT President James R. Killian, Jr., one of President Eisenhower's science advisors, to improve U.S. safeguards against surprise attack. The panel's Intelligence Committee, headed by Polaroid founder Edwin H. Land, reviewed a number of proposals, including several submitted by the Air Force, to peek at denied Soviet territory. Over the short term, the panel recommended a high-flying plane that would come to be called the U-2. Killian and Land met with President Eisenhower to push the idea. The project was approved, and the CIA had the job of carrying it out. If a pilot was shot down, the government wanted him to be a civilian who could claim to be conducting meteorological research. Over the long term, the panel recommended lofting satellites into space. Alan W. Dulles, then director of Central Intelligence, asked Richard Bissell, who would later go on to oversee the Bay of Pigs invasion, to direct the U-2 project. Bissell got in touch with Kelly Johnson, who ran Lockheed's Advanced Development Projects office, and he came up with the design for a plane that would fly as high as 70,000 feet. "Before that, we didn't have many successful spy operations into Soviet territory," Bissell recalled. "They were too tough and too good. When a society is that regimented, it is very hard for an outsider to move in and move around." What never came out at the time was that midway through the program, the British began participating in the flights, often alternating their pilots with American pilots. Eisenhower approved American flights only reluctantly, and Bissell said he approached the British as a way of getting more flights. "There wasn't a fixed arrangement, but there were some British pilots," Bissell said. "I arranged it. I thought it would improve our chances of being allowed to fly reconnaissance missions." Aware of the flights almost from the beginning, Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, protested secretly through diplomatic channels. At times, the Soviet military tried to knock the planes out of the sky, but its MiGs and surface-to-air missiles could not reach the altitude of the U-2. The flights continued for 4 years. Near the end, their goal was to determine if the Soviets were ahead of the U.S. in producing the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, ICBM. "The question was, do they have them and where are they?" a former CIA officer who worked on targeting the U-2 said. "We watched them test them on radar. We were hoping to get the capability sooner or later. But it was terrifying to Americans. The thought of coming under bombing was terrifying." Khrushchev had boasted that the Soviets had ICBMs that could hit U.S. targets. The claim was given added credibility by the Soviet launch on October 4, 1957, of Sputnik 1, Earth's first artificial satellite. Then came the missile gap, a perception that the Soviets were ahead of the U.S. in missile production. During the 1960 presidential campaign, John F. Kennedy had claimed a great gap existed in the numbers of operational ICBMs each country had. Previously, a controversy had erupted over a bomber gap. This misperception was a new twist on an old military ploy, fooling the enemy by marching the same regiment through a clearing over and over. Only in this case, the Soviets ordered the same plane squadrons to fly repeatedly overhead during parades. At the time, neither the U.S. nor the USSR had any missiles in production. The U.S. Air Force estimated the Soviets would soon have many more than the U.S., while a more conservative view of the Army, Navy, and CIA proved to be far more accurate. By 1963, the Air Force was estimating that the Soviets had 1,500 ICBMs, while the CIA said they had 400 to 500. In fact, the Soviets had 150 ICBMs in 1963, while the U.S. had 400. This illustrates a common problem when the military assesses the strength of opposing forces. Each service wants to use intelligence to support its own budget requests. The Air Force came in with an estimated number of missiles several times higher than ours, standard practice in the 1950s that became traditional over the next two decades, according to R. Jack Smith, the CIA's Deputy Director for Intelligence from 1966 to 1971. Theirs, as usual, was the worst-case stance, quite defensible in military tradition in determining what is the worst threat the enemy can pose. The CIA approach was to search out the most likely, not the worst possible, and then leave it to the President and his advisers to decide whether it was better to prepare defenses for the conceivable worst, the most likely, or something in between. On May 1, 1960, on the eve of summit talks with Khrushchev, the Soviets shot down a U-2 piloted by Francis Gary Powers, who had been an Air Force pilot. One of the targets of the flight was a suspected ICBM site at Plesetsk in northwest Russia. The CIA had assured Eisenhower that evidence that the plane was on a spy mission would never be recovered. Based on that assurance, he issued a public denial that the U-2 had been spying. Khrushchev promptly displayed reconnaissance photographs taken by the U-2, and the Soviet leader canceled the summit. After being captured, Powers was imprisoned and later traded for KGB officer Rudolf Abel. Powers died on August 1, 1977, when the Cessna he was piloting as a traffic reporter for WGIL Radio in Los Angeles crashed. Eisenhower ordered a halt to the U-2 program, but by then the CIA had already begun development of its first satellite program, codenamed Corona. The first satellites could see for 200 miles in any direction, whereas the U-2 could see only for 25 miles. Resolution was inferior to that of photos taken from the U-2, so the CIA employed analysts to decipher the images. A satellite indeed located a Soviet missile site in Plesetsk, the area where the U-2 was headed when it was shot down. From then on, the CIA successfully tracked the development of every Soviet weapon. The agency could see Soviet military hardware while it was being made, and could predict how long it would take before it was deployed. The first satellite increased our knowledge 50%, a former CIA officer involved in the project said. We were seeing things we had never seen before, the military and scientific installations. It was virginal information on their shipyards. We watched submarines, ships come on. While the U.S. agreed not to fly the U-2 over the Soviet Union, it did not agree to ground it. It was the U-2 that spotted Soviet missiles being installed by the Soviets in Cuba, leading to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. The first satellites catapulted the film toward Earth by parachute. Planes scooped up the exposed film in mid-air with buckets. Each successive satellite system improved resolution and range. The latest satellites, called KH-11s, transmit images electronically to Earth. At any given time, the U.S. has at least two KH-11s working. More recently, the U.S. has begun launching KH-12s, a more advanced satellite that takes in a wider swath of the electromagnetic spectrum. While they can read numbers on license plates, the satellites are usually set to spy on a wider area with resolution that is not as great. The Soviets have never come close to American ingenuity in developing satellites. The U.S. compensated for motion by rotating the cameras within the satellites. The CIA generally takes 30 to 40 shots for every 3 taken by the Soviets, making better use of satellite time. Meanwhile, the Directorate of Science and Technology developed methods for snooping on the Soviets underwater. One of the more ingenious projects was the Glomar Explorer, a ship built by the CIA to raise a Soviet submarine that had sunk in 1968 in 17,500 feet of water off the coast of California. As a cover, the Glomar was outfitted to gather manganese nodules from the ocean floor. In fact, it contained elaborate machinery for raising the Soviet submarine. In 1974, the Glomar set out for the site where the Soviet submarine had gone down. Because of undersea listening devices, the CIA had heard the ship go down and knew exactly where it was on the ocean floor. The Glomar lowered a recovery vehicle with several sets of claws to grab hold of the submarine. The recovery vehicle was lowered by extending 12-inch diameter pipes that were screwed together by the crew end-to-end and attached to the vehicle. When the submarine had been raised to the mothership, a chamber in the hull of the Glomar opened up and allowed the vehicle carrying the submarine to enter the ship. Meanwhile, television cameras monitored the project. After the sub was inside the hull, the water was pumped out. When Jack Anderson publicized the story, the CIA put out the word that the mission had been largely unsuccessful and that most of the important parts of the submarine had been lost when the sub broke in two. The submarine had broken in two, and half of it sunk once again to the bottom of the sea. But from the portion retained, the CIA recovered a number of key components, including two nuclear-tipped torpedoes, cryptographic machines, and parts of missiles. You got the sense of the state of the art of the Soviets. Electronics, code books, nuclear devices. What wasn't pulled up was more of the same, said a former CIA officer with knowledge of the take. The stories saying it was unsuccessful were part of the cover. Were you going to say we did a great job? In 1976, the Navy took possession of the Glomar Explorer, and now it is in mothballs in Suisun Bay, near San Francisco, as part of the National Defense Reserve Fleet. Today, the Directorate of Science and Technology controls billion-dollar satellites that see through clouds and even buildings with radar and infrared imaging that senses heat. Other satellites can intercept conversations of terrorists, trace narcotics dealers' electronic transfers of money between bank accounts, and see mobs in places such as Iraq, a machine gun under a tent, and water or oil under the desert. The satellites pick up virtually every part of the electromagnetic spectrum. Most important, they can see and transmit in real time any hostile moves by the Soviets or other countries. The National Reconnaissance Office, NRO, started in 1960, determines what types of satellites to develop and how they will be used. The NRO is, in fact, a committee that consists of representatives of the dozen agencies that make up the intelligence community. It has staff offices behind a locked door in room 4C1000 of the Pentagon, and in other locations. Its members often meet in the office of the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Despite repeated references to the NRO in the press, it is still considered a black program, meaning that from the standpoint of the U.S. government, it does not exist. The critical decisions are made by the NRO's Executive Committee, which consists of the Deputy Secretary of Defense, who is the chairman, the science advisor to the president, and the Director of Central Intelligence. It is the DCI, in his role as Director of the Intelligence Community, who is in charge of requirements. This gives him the authority to control the satellites, assigning them to different areas of the world and making the decision to turn them on and off. The NRO receives proposals for new systems from each of the intelligence agencies. Larger projects must be approved by the president. Once the NRO approves a project, it is carried out either by the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology or by the Air Force Space Command. Some 70% of the funding for the projects comes from the Defense Department, while the rest comes from the CIA funneled through Defense Department accounts. Day-to-day tasking of the imagery satellites is done by the Director of Central Intelligence through the Committee on Imagery Requirements and Exploitation, COMIREX, which is headed by a CIA officer. Usually, the committee meets at the office of the Intelligence Community staff at 1724 F Street Northwest in downtown Washington. The staff of 240 helps the Director of Central Intelligence coordinate the dozen agencies that make up the intelligence community. In effect, while the NRO operates the satellites, it is the Director of Central Intelligence who clicks the shutter. It is also the CIA, along with the military, that analyzes the results through the National Photographic Interpretation Center.